Blog Talk Radio.
Well, hello and welcome to today's podcast segment. We have the honor and the privilege of interviewing Mr. Matt Katzer, the CEO and the owner of Camond IT. They are one of the top-notch cybersecurity companies out in the West Coast area in Oregon. And Matt's actually been a guest on our podcast series, I believe, back in June or July. So I'd like to welcome him again. And today's topic is going to be more about cybersecurity insurance and more about their product line as it relates to Microsoft. Matt, thanks, and welcome to the show.
Well, thanks, Robbie. Thanks for inviting me.
Yeah, it's great. It's a great honor again to have you on board again today. So let's go ahead and get started. As I said, you know, cybersecurity insurance is like one of the big hot topics today in the industry. You know, and when people buy an insurance policy, they're not sure if they're covered, not covered, so forth. So we'll touch on that and as it relates to your Microsoft product offering. So let's get started. Now, Microsoft has changed their security software a lot over the years. It's the best in class in all the Gartner quadrants, and a lot of the software offering is, you know, it's top notch. I use it all the time. I use their Microsoft Word mostly for my tech writing, and I've got to be honest, I think their Microsoft Word is really, it's the best ever, and I think their editing and their proofreading tools are the best ever I've ever seen. But now, I know that you can't really reveal a lot of, like, proprietary information into their financial investments, but what's driving Microsoft to improve their security offerings of their products, you know, especially like the Office 365 products, Microsoft Azure, and so forth?
Well, yeah, I mean, it's really interesting because then you get into, I think what's really happening with Microsoft is, you know, we're part of a lot of partner advisory committees and we see a lot of meet with a lot of internal people. But when they look at like the Windows 7 days and you look at Windows 10, there's a fundamental switch that happened. And what really came down is that you have a group of engineers and architects are basically got tired of the market beating them up for not putting functionality and security features in their products. And from a culture standpoint, it's kind of interesting. And this happens with Satya, if you've listened to his conversations. And I had opportunity to actually talk with him, and in some of the previews we met with him. It's just a fundamental philosophy change. They want to be best of class. They're really tired, and it's more of a, it's almost a personal endeavor that they want to be, they want their software and their tools and everything to be best of class, and they're tired of being beaten up in the marketplace about them. And I think that started about 3 years ago, and you can really see this in terms of the product offering and everything else, especially when you look at Microsoft, that you realize that like 50% of the world voice traffic goes over their networks. And the amount of systems and everything they have, they're like the number one company that's constantly attacked. And they've really just taken, it's a matter of personal pride. They just want to be best of class, and that's what they're doing. And the security products, which are layered security products, really are the best of class now. It's just amazing how this stuff works.
Okay. Now, how is Microsoft as a cybersecurity vendor? Now, I wasn't really aware that Microsoft actually had, like, devoted standalone security products. Can you give some examples of that?
Yeah, the way that Microsoft actually has, when you think of, like, the Microsoft Cloud Services, you have Azure, you have the virtual networks and everything else, you have the VMs and Azure. On the 365 side, and for your readers that actually understand, the way we think of Microsoft Cloud is you think of Azure as a Microsoft Cloud, you think of things like Office 365 as an application that runs in it. And when you talk about what's going on, there's a fundamental shift of the whole philosophy of security. It's all built around what we call identity management. And to actually answer your question, in the old days, what you would do in order to protect, you had this concept known as a ComSec or communication security boundary. And that was the physical wall that was built around the building and everything else. And so as a user went into a building, you had to prove your identity, who you were before they let you go into the facilities. Now, in today's world of the cloud, where everything's disconnected, you have cloud services, you have IoT devices, you have NIST thermometers, whatever you have in your house, we have a connected society. The what's happening is the identity of the user is really the security boundary. So when you look at that philosophy, what Microsoft has done with their Active Directory products and everything else, they created the security boundary, and they say, okay, now we as how do we actually protect that? And they started developing layers of security on it. And a lot of this is a byproduct of what they had to, you know, they have 250,000 employees worldwide. And what do you have to put in place to make sure the code's protected, make sure the intellectual property and the digital assets are protected? And because of that, Microsoft has developed a set of security products, and they, over time, they morph. Originally, years ago, we used to have something called Forefront and the Internet Security Advisory software that used to run the ISA software. And now what's happening is really interesting because in Azure you have software-defined firewalls. You have layered software that basically runs on your Windows 10 system that basically has the capabilities almost greater than what CloudStrike does in terms of how it actually looks at the threats and the threat actors that handling the system. The way you process emails going through the system of communication, the phishing, and the type of different activities ago that was you would have with different vendors like Barracudas and others that you would actually process, that's all there now because you have this layered model. And then on the virtual machines and protecting how the virtual machines are built in Azure, you have to have the layered security model in place. So you got to be able to detect a bad actor if it gets into the environment. And now you're putting all these pieces together, they're basically, you know, they're fundamentally built into the operating system or the infrastructure, but they're actually add-on pieces. And, you know, they've even got to the extent now that you can find, like, some of the threat detection software is available on non-Microsoft platforms, be it if you're running, like, a Mac OS or you're running, like, you know, Linux boxes and everything else. There's threat agents that run in those environments because it's about the identity. And when you actually look at the identity of the user, that's what you have to protect now. And you have to have a layered security model. And that's really is gave the birth to, about a few years ago to Microsoft security practice. And it really is number one class. If you deploy the security structure right, deploy the various pieces and get the configurations correct, you literally don't have problems.
Okay, excellent. Now, I've been hearing this term quite a bit, end of life, and I think you had mentioned in a previous conversation that Windows 7 end of life is coming on the 20th of next year in 2020. Actually, it's kind of unusual, January 20th, 2020, but what does end of life exactly mean, and does it mean that the OS is just no longer functioning, or does it mean its support simply ends? Can you provide some insight into that, please?
Well, I'll give you two perspectives. From the IT side of me, you can hear the sirens go off and the bells and the whistles and everything else. We're glad to get rid of it. But from a practical standpoint, what, you know, because, you know, it's just basically it's old. But from a practical standpoint, when Microsoft does an end of life on a product, that means that there's no longer going to be any security fixes for it. There's no longer going to be any patches for it. Whatever comes on January 2020, that's it. There's no support. You can't get support for it. Doesn't really matter if you have trying to, even if you have security keys or trying to install it, there's no guarantee that you will be even to install new versions of the software. That's end of life means literally there is no more support. And there's good reasons for it, too, because, I mean, if you look at Windows 7, I mean, right now Windows 7 is, what, 14 years old? And so that means it was put into another 3 years develop on top of it. So it's like 17 years old. It's pretty old. And it's really not designed for today's world. But so what happens is when you end of life, that's now there's big companies that have, like, environments built on Windows 7. They're critical business applications. So for those specific customers, what happens is that, you know, Microsoft has a program called the End of Life Service that you can actually go through and buy support and fixes for those specific systems for 1 or 2 years. And they have a program associated with it. So you can get like a 2-year extension, but it's very costly. The cost of the 2-year extension is greater than the cost of buying a new Windows 10 system.
Okay. Now, suppose you have a, let's take this for an example. Now, we have the end of life coming up early next year in January. What if some of your customers still use Windows 7 beyond that time frame and they still want your support? Are you going to still give support to those customers the best that you can, or how is that going to work for you?
Well, we're caught in a predicament because the only way that we can actually support them is if they actually sign up for the end of service program and that Microsoft will support it. And the problem you have to really, and this is, gets into the whole compliance and cybersecurity management and everything else, because if you have a Windows 7 system and you are in a any type of organization that had compliant requirements, unless you sign up for the extended end of service, you are out of compliance. So if you have a data breach or something else or something happens, there'll be absolutely no, the insurance companies will say, well, you know, you're a bad person. That's the way it goes. Go pay your bills. Or if you run into a situation, get a compliance audit, like you do through do a HIPAA audit for a PCI or something like that, or even on the news, some of the standards aren't being pushed through by the federal government for in our contracts or our DoD side. You're no longer compliant. You're not eligible for different services. Some of your contracts could get canceled. It's actually pretty vicious. Our policy, from our standpoint, from us, yeah, we'll support Windows 7 system as long as you sign up for the end of service program. But realistically, if you're a small business and you want to sign up for the end of service program, it's much more cost effective to just go out and buy a brand new PC with Windows 10 Pro on it and just end of life your system. And that's just the way it is. It's time to move on. I mean, look yourself. Do you have your old cell phone that you had from 14 years ago? You know, that big brick with the antenna on it, four-pound thing you put in the side?
Well, I got mine from 2014. I'm going to have to get a new one pretty soon, I think. But anyway. So,
it's the same type of thing. They have to really think about what it really means on this stuff.
Okay. Now that leads to another question in terms of cybersecurity insurance policies. Will an insurance company, like for example, Allstate, Nationwide, or State Farm, suppose SMB owner gets their policy through them and they were hit with a security breach, but it was discovered after the claim was filed that they had an end of life service that was being used, will their claim still be denied by the insurance company if they didn't audit and found out that's what actually happened? Or how is that going to take place? I mean, are they that picky about that, these insurance companies?
Well, yeah, you have to. I mean, I can't speak specifically like State Farm or Allstate, the policies, because all insurance companies have unique policies on them. And a lot of times the insurance companies even the major ones use like brokers to actually go get policies. Ours, for instance, our cyber policies are out of Lloyd's of London. But what happens on the policy, you have to actually really look at the policies, because a lot of the insurance policies today, they have that you have to use best practices. You have to have standard. You have to prove that you are doing the necessary things, the standard operating procedures about, did you do the necessary backups? Did you do the updates associated to the machines? Do you have a firewall installed? There's all sorts of requirements in the policies. And you got to keep in mind that insurance policies are, and this is my personal view, insurance policies are like a safety net. But their business, if we get right down to it, is, yeah, their business is to kind of make sure, give you a feeling that things are, that you're covered. But at the same time, their goal is not to pay out on insurance policies. So if you look in terms of situation, doesn't matter which policy you have, you need to follow the rules associated with the policy and make sure you comply to it. And one of the things that happen in a lot of policies, like I know ours has it in, if you basically have devices that are end of service, that are basically no longer supported by the manufacturer, and you get a breach on it, you're SOL. That's just the way it is. That's a reason to deny a claim.
Wow. Didn't realize that. Okay. Now, I've been using Microsoft suite of products like the, especially the Word and the PowerPoint Excel ever since college, which was, you know, way back when. And when I got my first few laptops, I mean, until up until just a few years ago, the Microsoft Office came with a laptop where you had to buy like a little card and you had to get the key and, you know, the Geek Squad, they would install it, you know, with the key. But now everything is off into the cloud with the O365. Now, as a small business owner, what kind of software should I use? Because there's just so much that's on there now. And what subscription level should I be using? Is there just one type of O365 for an SMB, or are there multiple tiers? Can you please explain that in more detail?
Oh, yeah. I mean, we have this question many times. In fact, we just were talking to a client the other day about a very similar and trying to help them, you know, maneuver through it. I mean, licensing and software in terms of offering doesn't matter which company you talk to, it's just a very complex issue. And part of the complexity is there's so many options. When you look at things like Office software, like your comment, Microsoft really has one Office product, but there's different versions of it depending on the uses. You have the home business version, or you have a what we call the personal version. You have like a volume license designed for bigger companies, and you have the subscription version. And there's different license grants and rules associated with it. And when you actually go out and buy a PC, for instance, or you buy a Mac and it has Office on or something like that, what happens is that Microsoft gives you on that device, there'll be a personal trial. And it's usually the home or business version that they have the personal trial. And the user is required to basically decide if they want to subscribe to that, or they go through and to subscribe to it, they'll need an email address or log into the Microsoft subscription website with their email address and basically go purchase a copy through the Microsoft store and activate it. And that's really the way the software is done now today. So it's activated. Now, from a business standpoint, when you look at those are really, we really divide the world up in really two types of product mixes or two types of cloud. You have the retail version of product, that's the personal home business, and you have the commercial products. When we talk about 365 subscriptions like today in this podcast, I'm actually talking about the 365 commercial products. Now, in the 365 commercial products, you can have a one-person business or one user go purchase a copy of Office 365 Business. It gives you Office and Word and everything else, and download it on your PC. And, you know, there's a standard price set for that. And it basically, you know, the stuff just works. And what Microsoft has done is that when they look at the environment, they have this concept of you have a home business user that's on the retail side, what we call, and then you have really a concept called small business. And in the Microsoft vernacular, what a small business is talking about companies with less than 300 people. So in a company that has less than 300 employees, Microsoft allows you to buy discounted big boy or what we call the enterprise subscriptions, and you can actually get, like, instead of paying $20 a user a month for the enterprise office, you get a small business version of the same thing for like $12.50. And so there's that different price point of those two things that's really based on employee size. So as a consumer, or, you know, even in business, we're still consumer. When you go purchase, let's say I go down to, like, you know, the office supply store, and I buy a PC from the office supply store, I'm going to pick that PC is going to have the home office retail version of Office software. If I go through and buy a PC from an online manufacturer like Dell or Lenovo, what will happen is that chances are that PC will not have any Office software on it, because the assumption is that as a business, I'm either going to go to the Microsoft portal.office.com, I have an Office 365 subscription, and I'm going to download the appropriate version for my hardware, which is more the commercial version, which is what we offer for our clients. And that's really
excellent.
And then you have the other extreme that you have, we call volume license. And that's where you have the traditional keys associated, where you actually get a key for software. And those are designed for more of, you know, volume, basically businesses that are deploying, like, you know, 500 PCs, and they need the 500 copies of Office, and they have a certain way they want their Office to work. It's a legacy design. It's a legacy model, but it allows them to basically buy copies of software and manage the asset. The ironic thing is the cost today is you can do the traditional way with these volume license keys, or you do basically the subscription services online. And the subscription services for the 365 commercial are just almost less cost than doing the old volume license model.
Okay, excellent.
Does that kind of give you an idea? Because it's really complex. I was trying to figure out how the best way to simplify it for everyone.
Yeah, I mean, it's a complex business model, I think. You know, I mean, because as I said, when I got my laptop, it was just like, you know, one-tier system. You just go and download, you know, you just get the stuff already on there. But I guess with the cloud, that kind of – but, you know, you have greater availability for your needs too, which makes it even, you know, more versatile. So that kind of leads me to the next question here. Most of us have probably heard of the Amazon Web Services and has the 800-pound gorilla for, you know, being a cloud service provider. And Microsoft has their own, version of that, for lack of a better term, called Azure. What is this Azure, like Microsoft Cloud? Is it the same thing as AWS, or are there any differentiators among the two? And is Azure just like another ISP? I have my web hosting through a company called Namecheap. I think they're out of Russia, so I don't know where they're at. But is Azure a place for small businesses or for software developers or even for the biggest of the Fortune 500 companies? Is it like a free-for-all for everybody, or can you explain all that, please?
To really think about it, let me just kind of step back and give you some a good way to look at it. When you go down and saying when AWS was created, what really was happening is Amazon needed, basically, they had a hosting service. And they needed a way to actually, because everything was built to support their online store. In order to actually, and so you look in history, they built, in essence, a hosting environment so they can basically handle their Amazon services so that we can go purchase products and everything else. Now, in the process of doing that, Amazon discovered something was interesting, that people would come, you know, between November and December, they basically would have to have tons and tons of servers to basically meet the demands. But during the rest of the year, they actually had no demand at all. And so what do you do with all this hardware? Well, someone came up with the idea of Amazon Web Services and selling the cloud services as a for businesses. And that's kind of how the whole, when you think about the cloud, big cloud computing model, their hosting model got started, that's how it all put in place. Now, the Microsoft has a similar thing, too, because most people don't realize that when you look at the number of, we all had a Hotmail account at one time, and if you look at the amount of Hotmail accounts that are actually existing and the complete infrastructure required to do that. Now, Microsoft didn't have a fancy name. I think it was called a Global Foundation Services or some weird thing like that. But that was originally when it was put together. But today, when we look at the Microsoft Cloud Services, we really kind of almost say we call it Azure, and that's an easy way to describe it because we don't think of all the pieces. But the differences that we have in, over time, and this is kind of the interesting part, is that the Amazon services were really put together in a model where you could kind of come in at any level, and if you wanted to build RAID hardware on top of it, you can do software RAID. You can basically build different type of services and everything on top of it. Microsoft's strategy, when they basically looked in terms of how they were actually entering the cloud market, they changed their strategy to a certain extent. They basically said that we're going to take the approach of more of a platform as a service or an infrastructure as a service. And what happened in that world is that when you actually go into the Microsoft, so when you actually start spinning up, you want to spin up a virtual machine or something like that, they basically built an environment, make it really super easy to do that. Now, at the same time, then that was their, as Microsoft put in the environment, and then Amazon does a similar thing, so they kind of race them back and forth. And so now you have this area where that it doesn't really matter if I could be a developer if I wanted to. I could be a small business. In fact, we have a lot of small businesses that actually have services in Azure. And that basically they run their businesses out of Azure. And things are changed. It really comes down to you can actually do everything. I think you have, personally, I think you have more flexibility in Azure than AWS. But a lot of it comes down to what is the line of business application? What are you trying to do? From a security standpoint and view, the Microsoft has took a step back a few years ago, and they looked at Azure from a standpoint of how do we actually make it more secure? How do we make it more integrated with the different services so you have much more integrated offering? As an example of this is that on the cybersecurity side, now we're talking about a SIEM, which is basically that is what it, that is kind of this large security information and event management collection tool. And there's companies like Splunk or ArcServe that basically sell this service. Well, Microsoft has the same thing too, and it's called Azure Sentinel. Now, the reason why I mentioned that up because Azure Sentinel is designed so there's connectors into AWS, so you can actually manage all the security of your AWS infrastructure through Microsoft Azure Security Services. That's how stuff is changing so much. And it really, well, as a business, when you look at it saying that I'm a small business, I may have a, you know, small business, 5 or 6 people, I, you know, want to keep my inventory management system somewhere, well, I may actually have a server application and put that into Azure. So everybody can do that. And it's just like with the Windows 10 virtual desktops, you can do the same thing now too. It's just all, it's all integrated. It's all about security. It's pretty cool.
Okay. So one question, how did they get the name Azure? I mean, I've been asked that a couple times. What does Azure really mean?
Oh boy, that's a good one. I think the original name was I think the original code name of Azure was Red Dog. And what happens is when you come up with the code names, you know, code names are kind of interesting thing. You got to find a name that, first of all, nobody has. And if you're an international company, you got to make sure that whatever name you pick doesn't mean any bad things if you go into different lands, because you got to watch what you say. And different companies have different names, have different different names. And then you also want to make sure that you can grab all the intellectual property rights along with the name. So my guess is Azure was, let's come up with something cool. And, oh, by the way, let's make sure we have all the intellectual property associated with it. And also let's make sure it doesn't have any bad connotations as it goes throughout the world. And that's I think that's how naming's done today in today's society more than anything else.
Well, okay. Well, it's definitely a unique name. It's definitely an eye catcher. So anyway, I just don't want to ask another question is, when I think of Office 365, I primarily think of the PowerPoint, Excel, Word. That's always been my thinking of that ever since, you know, I've been using it since college. What really is Office 365 these days? I mean, is it more than than just those three products, or, I mean, what is it exactly? I mean, what does it encompass? What kind of products are in there? And what should an SMB really be using? I mean, if they're not an IT shop, suppose they're like a mom and pop retail store with an online store, what should they be using?
Well, that's really a good question. I mean, that's one of the reasons why when we wrote our books, we wrote, like, we have two Office 365 books, and we also have our latest one, Securing Office 365. But really, the good one that you actually look at today, and before I actually talk about kind of what people should use, think of Campbell's soup. You go into the grocery store or the supermarket, and you think of Campbell's soup. Now, do you go into the grocery store to buy Campbell's soup, or are you going to buy cream of mushrooms, or are you going to buy steak and potato, or are you going to buy the chili, and so you think of that. When you think of 365, 365 is like Campbell's soup. There's different versions of it, and there's different pieces that are in 365 depending on the business needs. So for like a small business, for instance, you know, really what you need in a small business is really a couple things. You need to have your Teams, which is your voice system, and then your collaboration app. You need to have the Office software. You need to have clouds that you can run on your desktop or run in the cloud. You need to have capabilities for email, and you have to have storage. And you get 2 terabytes of personal storage per user. So that's kind of the basic. That's kind of the basic package. And when you look at the pieces of a small business, you can basically for, you know, $12 a month, you can turn around and get all the, you know, everything you need to do. You got Office software, you got your Teams collaboration, you can do video conference calls, you have your clouds, 2 terabytes of cloud storage, you have capabilities like that. And when we, I know it has been announced, but if we look at what's happening over in Europe and the UK and Canada, Microsoft introduced a concept called Business Voice. So now you're going to be able to take one of these small business subscriptions and add your PSTN, your dial-in phone numbers to this whole thing at a very reasonable price on this stuff. But those are what, you know, because that's how businesses, small businesses work. You want to have the tools necessary to do your job, and that's where the target is. That's what a small business needs. So you have this Campbell soup offering, but a lot of those things are targeted for larger companies or people that have more, you have compliance needs, you have more in-type security needs. But for a small business, you actually look at the small business versions, which are really, there's only really four versions of small business software. And it's one of those four people are going to use. And then as you look at your special needs, you can add some of the bigger company enterprise features to it to give you the capabilities for those special things like compliance and everything else. But that's really the key of it. And as businesses goes today, you know, the key thing that we're seeing that really drives everything is you got to have Teams. And it basically gives you Teams, basically collaboration, all from the desktop Outlook software. It's just really pretty cool.
Well, okay. Now, is like Microsoft Word, PowerPoint, Excel, is that now only available through O365, or is there like another way to get like a traditional CD package? Because I know there's some people out there that kind of like doing things the old-fashioned way. They don't want to go to the internet, download stuff. They kind of want to have something they can hold and put into a CD tray. You know, if computers even still come with that anymore. Does Microsoft still have something like that, or?
Yeah, I mean, there's two versions of it. You can cut through all the chase. You have the subscription versions for in 365, and then you have the volume license version. And in the volume license versions, you can actually go through and you basically are buying like a minimum quantity of 5. You can get put the bits on a CD, install them, have the traditional key. That's the way you can actually have those. That's called volume license. Those are really the only two ways to get through. You know, because a lot of times people will go through and say, I'll go to eBay and someone will sell me an Office software, you know, for $75 with a key download. you know, like got bad news for you, that's probably pirated. So really is there's very little ways that you can actually buy the full package product now. You have to do it through volume license.
Okay. Now let's kind of segue now into cybersecurity in general. I went to a bunch of networking sessions, you know, events last week, and you know, people asked me, what is cybersecurity? And believe it or not, I had to scratch my head for a few moments and kind of think, really, what is cybersecurity? Are we talking about just protecting our computers from a digital standpoint? Does it involve physical security, like protecting our doors, putting in card readers? And as in your opinion, Matt, as a IT provider, you know, for Microsoft, what is cybersecurity? How do you define that for your customers and people that ask you that question?
Well, there's really, when you talk about security in general, and, you know, we talk about cybersecurity, there's really two components of it. There is the digital components. Do we have the necessary detection software? We have the necessary monitoring things. Do we have the necessary backups? Do we have the necessary ways for business continuation? Those are, there's technical software packages that we do and need to basically make sure that happen. And that's called more what, when people talk about cybersecurity, you know, 9 times out of 10, that's what they're referring to. They're referring to securing the digital assets is the easy way to look at it. The other part of cybersecurity that we basically, where people have a hard time that they don't really talk about, it's because it comes down to the SOP. What is your standard operating procedures of the business? How do you actually manage the data? What process do you have? Do you have a document for the acceptable use in terms of bringing cell phones to the environment? What's your policies for that? What's your policies for adding users to the environment? What's your policy for removing employees? Do you have policies that, you know, if you see a bunch of USB drives on the drop down in the front of your door, your office building, do you pick one of those up and take them and run them inside? And of course, the answer is no. And nowadays, you have to look at, do you have a lot, because cell phone cables, like iPhone cables, are smart cables, and some of USB-Cs are. You have to see a bunch of those lying on the ground. You have the same problem, because it's about the management, because those things can actually be bad cables from the standpoint that they have injection or Trojans in them. And so when you think of cybersecurity in general, we think of it as a from a standpoint that it's really two components. One is the management of the digital assets from a technology standpoint, and the other is the business processes that the organization uses to actually make sure that the assets are managed correctly. When you look at insurance now is the new insurance policies that we're seeing are actually saying, do you do the physical management and do you do the business process management so that we know that you did your due diligence and we can guarantee you and make sure pay you if you actually have a loss.
Okay. Now, one question I get asked is, you know, when I approach people, like when I do their writing projects, like, okay, what are all these kinds of policies? I mean, we keep hearing about a security policy. We keep talking about a business continuity policy, a disaster recovery plan, incident response, so forth, so forth. What's the difference between all? So, you know, there's probably like 4 or 5 things I just threw out at you. Like, what's an incident response plan? What's disaster recovery? What's business continuity? Just from a general standpoint, can you give your 2 cents worth on that for our audience?
Oh, yeah. I mean, an incident response, we'll start with the top of your list. An incident response plan is basically a document that the business has, and we have samples that we mail on our website that people can download and get from us. But basically, it's if you have a security incident, what do you do? Who should you contact? What is the processes that you follow and everything else? And in terms of and that's kind of what an incident response plan. There's different versions of them depending on the complexity you want to have. And depending what your risk factor associated with it. And when you talk about basically disaster recovery, and there's really is two parts of disaster recovery. One part is that do we have backups to recover the data? And the other part for disaster recovery is, do we have business continuity to actually make sure that business can continue running if a disaster hits? And as example, look, and you need both of them. When we talk about disaster recovery, it's really have two components. You need both components. As an example, let's say we have an environment. We have a you have a small business that has five servers and maybe 10 users in the business, and they have all their orders and their financial information and everything else on those servers. So what happens, we all know that they probably have backups to make sure if someone deletes a file, they can recover it. But the other piece of that they want to have is a disaster recovery. Now, in our case, we use like Azure as the hosting disaster recovery service. So what this does is when we run software on the servers, so the servers are actually duplicated into the Microsoft cloud, into the Azure cloud, so that when you, let's say that someone blows up the building or you have a disaster or an earthquake or something like that happens, immediately the servers fail over into Azure and the business continues running. That's disaster recovery. And then that's different from if you have a backup saying that, yeah, I can back up my data, but it's basically there's work associated with, I have to rebuild the servers, put new information on it, and everything else. And backups are really designed to say, how do I recover this file or how to get this old data, not necessarily a disaster recovery. So you need, that's kind of the both that you need. And that's kind of the basis. And the third thing, we talk about business continuity, is business continuity is basically a term that, and this came about because of a lot of with the mail servers were being on-premise, like you had an Exchange server or you had a PopMail server in your office. What happens is that the mail server would go through a service, and that service would forward you the mail to the email to your on-premise server. Now, if something happened to your on-premise server or if you had a bad link, then the mail would be cached into that device in the cloud or that external device. And that's where a lot of the business continuity concept came from. You know, you think of things like Mindcast, for instance, or the Barracuda appliances. They do offer that service, but in essence, that's really what it is. It's caching the email to make sure the business can continue to run.
Okay. Now, you know, as a technical writer in cybersecurity, you know, I come across a lot of news headlines of data security. We keep hearing about all these, you know, pieces of personal identifiable information being hacked into. You know, people ask me, well, how do you secure data sets? How do you secure a database? In your opinion, Matt, really, what is data security? And really, what is data? Are we talking about metadata? Are we talking about, like, the PII of customers? Are we talking about intellectual property? I know it's an all-encompassing question, but what's your opinion on that?
Well, I mean, this is an interesting discussion because it comes down to in the past, businesses never really internalized that their data was a digital asset and needed to be protected. And when you think of businesses in general, the things that make sense, yeah, I got to keep my patent information, my ideas in-house, I got to keep, you know, my financials, make sure they're controlled. But what really, when you start looking at data security in general, you start looking at common things. It's like we all have client lists, for instance. Now, and if you actually sat down and you went through and figured out is what is the value of a landed customer? As you go through and talk to prospects and everything else, your salespeople talk to prospects, you get leads and everything else, you convert them to a customer, there's a value associated with that. And the value associated with that can be in, you know, I've seen costs of a landed customer anywhere from $2,000 to $3,000 on up in the tens of thousands of dollars to actually get that decision maker, get that landed customer. That digital asset costs that much. And when you look at a prospect and you look at a qualified lead that you actually get or a referral and you're trying to basically convert that to a customer, there's a cost associated with those things, and those can be like $200-$300. And when you start looking at a business now, let's say a business gets in, a small business saying, well, I don't need to worry about who wants my contact books and everything else. but you have to start looking at those contacts have value to you, but also value to your competitors. And you got to keep in mind that as we talk about cybersecurity and threats and everything else, it's about someone taking something of what you have, your digital assets, and reselling those because those have value. Now, personal information has value in the market. You know, a credit card, iTunes accounts, all those things have a digital value. All those things have a dollar value in the market to be sold on the and be sold in the dark web. And what you're doing is that you're now having a position, everyone's in a position of protecting that information because you have to basically secure it. Now, what's going on in terms of the, if you look throughout the U.S. and look what happened with California and their CCPA, the California Consumer Protection Act, and the new, I think in New York, they just passed the SHIELD Act. There's a similar one in Arizona. They now have an assumption that if you're a business of a certain size, and they're lowering the range all the time, and if you have information that is leaked or breached, personal information that goes out into the wild and sold, there's an, the courts are now saying that the way these bills are written, it is assumed that the breach has caused damage, and now the businesses are liable for under these statutes. And it was kind of interesting because you change the look way the legal system traditionally, you know, we're innocent until proven guilty and everything else. But the way these new laws are going in place, it's no longer up to a business to prove that someone has to prove that damage has happened to the business. Now what's happening is that damage is assumed and it's up to the business to prove that damage didn't happen or the data wasn't leaked. That's why data security and all this stuff is now important. Because it doesn't matter what, if it's personal information, it's going to come under one of these acts, and there's going to be fines associated with it. And it's and you're going to be writing checks.
Okay. Now, one thing we've been hearing, especially in the Microsoft jargon, or really in the cybersecurity industry in general, is like two-factor authentication, and not multi-factor authentication. That's obviously when you use more than one type of credential in order to gain access to a shared or network resource. Now, is that the same thing as a layered security model, or are there any differences between the multi-factor approach and the layered security approach?
Yeah, I mean, there's that's a really a good question because they're really totally different. The when you think of multi-factor authentication or two-factor authentication, I mean, we all know that two-factor is like, we have like we get an SMS text and we verify who we are. The modern way of happening now is that we're actually using fingerprints or biometrics to verify who we are. We run an authentication app on our phones to basically get a custom unique code. Those are basically those are identity, basically identity. It's really a it's an identity confirmation of the person. And then so that you are who you are to make sure you access something. That's really what that's all about. And it goes back to the original security thing where there's three things. Either you is something you know, something you have, or something you are. So something you know like a password, something you have like a device or a phone, something that you are like biometrics. You go those three, you have a pretty much almost a 100% guarantee the person is who the person say they are. So that's what multi-factor is and two-factor authentication. It's that part of it. Now, when we talk about a security model or a layered security model, what we're talking about is that we're the different security software you run in an environment that basically addresses different types of threats. Like multi-factor authentication does is addresses maybe one layer of identity, identity confirmation of the individual. You'll have another set of software that basically runs in the environment that basically looks for what we call lateral attacks that may come into a system that goes to a server or go to a different environment. That's another layer of software. You have another layer that is basically doing the that comes in doing the through the email services that looks at the is this coming from a good person or a bad person, and decides to do some filtering. We traditionally call those spam filtering. You have another layer that basically looks at the URLs and that has someone say, hey, go click on my URL, go see my whatever. And there's another set of software that looks at that and basically goes test those URLs and go make sure, is this a good site or is this a bad site? And so, you know, when you talk about layered security, it's those different layers of different types of tools. Now, what's really important especially when you see all these data breaches, what's happening is that people have a habit of not deploying a complete layered solution in their environment. And the bad actors find this out. And that's why you're seeing, like, in Texas, you had, like, 21 counties got hit, because the bad actor looked at what their solution was and whatever they decided in the counties to deploy as a standard, they didn't research and apply a layered solution. They pointed like, oh, I'm just going to do antivirus or that. I'm not going to worry about this other stuff. And so what happens, the bad actors know that, and they detect and they go target at people that deploy pinpoint projects. When you do a layered model, what's interesting is that as one layer, let's say the threat detection software that runs on the device looks for certain things. If you analyze that and look at it, it says, well, geez, they don't look at this scenario. But then there's another layer that basically is targeted for like lateral attacks. And it looks for that and will catch it. So then if you go target at the lateral attack layer, then what happens is the lower layer for that's looking at the threat detection will catch it. And so on and so on. So you get this layered model where each layer has and each vendor is different in this regard, but each layer has a specific focus of what they're trying to do. And if you deploy the complete vendor solution, you end up having something that cross-fits everything and basically plugs the holes where one layer does it. And that's the thing that gets, I think, today is really – you know, we do a lot with Microsoft, but I think today that's really the problem that people have. You cannot just you have to look at a complete model that crosses how the user works in the environment. And that's really, in our terms of our security products and everything else and the Microsoft stack, that's what we deploy. And we just don't have problems.
Excellent. Well, okay, now that kind of now leads to what I talked about at the beginning of the show, was cybersecurity insurance policies. As I had mentioned, that's now the big buzzword that's happening all across this industry and across, you know, companies. As they get breached, they're starting to realize, ooh, I need something to be able to protect myself. Now, is cybersecurity insurance now... is that comparable? Is it equal to like buying a car insurance policy, or like buying a health care insurance policy, you know, through Obamacare? What is cybersecurity insurance, and really, what is covered? I mean, are both the direct and indirect costs covered? For example, I view a direct cost would be okay, the costs are associated with bringing your business back up online after you've been hit. Indirect costs would be like, you know, reputational damage loss, loss of customers, lawsuits, giving your customers free, credit reporting or credit counseling services. What are your views on all that? Because it's such a murky area for people right now. And I think the confusion is, and I think where businesses get blindsided is that, okay, well, I've got a cybersecurity insurance policy, I'm protected under it, so no matter what happens to me, I am protected. But, you know, surprise, you may not get everything that, you know, you're paying for. I know it's a big question, it's a huge topic, but can you just give us your knowledge and all this, Mitt?
Yeah, I mean, if you look at, I'll go look at our example, and you got to keep in mind that before I actually kind of give you an idea, insurance, out of the 9 out of 10 cyber breaches are denied. And they're usually denied because people haven't put the right they haven't put the necessary standard operating procedures and policies in place. But you look at like cyber policies and step back for a second, is that like our cyber insurance policy, there are really two components on it. You have basically, there's a crime insurance policy side of it, and that's dealing with the theft. That if something does get in terms of, and there has to be a, you know, Bitcoin or something associated with it, or you wiring out, you know, $75,000 because you don't have a business process of how you control wires, you basically have a threat. You know, there's insurance coverage for that, and that's typically called the crime atom policies. Not all policies have those. And then you have the cyber insurance policy. Now, what the cyber insurance policy does, it basically really is, like you said, there's money associated to protect from lawsuits. There's money associated to protect in terms of reputation damage and everything else. And every policy is different with what they have on it. But in generally, what the policies are structured is to make sure the business is put back together whole. And that's kind of the philosophy on it. But like all insurance policies, you know, there's conditions and rules. What is not covered isn't covered. So you have to really look at the policy and then talk to the agents and say, okay, now what do I need to do? Like in our cases, what we have is we have in our higher end, our security policies, for instance, our Fortress plan. We have an option in there where you can actually, if you're a customer that's on our Fortress plan, you can get a cyber insurance policy through our Lloyd's of London environment, Lloyd's of London broker, because and we'll underwrite that as part of the Fortress plan. And because of that, what's happening is that we're required to do certain things. You have to have certain physical things in place. You have to have systems to be managed. You have to have the layered security model deployed. If you do all that, then the insurance company trusts us to basically act so that we can have them talk to and do a policy directly through like our broker if they wanted to. And the insurance companies are happy to do that because that we basically have vetted the client and we're managing the client. And what do? When we manage the client, we make sure the security alerts are taken care of. We make sure the updates are taken care of. We have standard operating procedures on how we actually manage things. And that's the piece of, and those are the key things. So if you come through and you think sometime as a business, oh, I have a cyber insurance policy, but you don't do any of these things, you're just throwing your money away because you're never going to get a claim. Your claims are going to get denied. Because that's what they're structured. You have to do your due diligence and treat it. Just like if you have a car, I know some states, but some states are structured that you have to get the car inspected. If you don't get the car inspected and you get into an accident on it, the insurance companies basically say, yeah, well, guess what? It's in violation of state law. We're not going to cover it, but we'll cover the other driver, but you're on your own, total your car.
Okay. Now, what are the typical reasons why cybersecurity insurance claims are denied? I think you kind of alluded to that before, but do you have specific examples that you can give as to why, like, maybe a customer or maybe someone else you know was denied a claim when they filed it?
Yeah, I mean, usually the ones I've seen that we've seen is that they have not updated their systems. That's a common one. Basically, they do a forensic analysis and find out that basically they refuse to put the security patches on their systems. I mean, that's how basic some of this stuff goes. You know, sometimes you end up with you look through the claims, they may go through and say, well, geez, you got a ransomware attack on it, but we did the forensic analysis on it and says, yeah, we can help you recover it, so we'll do a certain amount of damage recovery, but we're not going to basically pay for some of this stuff because if you did your due diligence like you're supposed to, we wouldn't have this claim and you wouldn't have this problem, and you're asking us to cover you in this particular ransomware attack. And the reality is that this was 100% provided, and you made a conscious decision not to do your due diligence as you required as an officer of the company. So why should, you know, why basically at that time are we responsible to actually pay for the damage? And that's where a lot of them go. And it's interesting from that standpoint because you're basically now, because there's with the breaches and everything else, you have a responsibility to do the necessary things and do the due diligence. Now, if you did the due diligence and you still got the breach and everything else, yeah, guess what? They'll pay your claim. And that's really the secret. You have to do your due diligence, and you have to have your processes in place.
So basically, the bottom line is, because you've been hit, you file a claim doesn't necessarily mean you're going to get the full value that you filed for, right? There's a lot more that takes place before you get that. Gotcha. Okay, I think that's where the fallacy among SMBs are at. I think that's the errant thing. They think, oh, yeah, we have it, and we're going to get covered. No, well, there's a lot more that goes to it. So, okay, now, I myself am a small business owner. I mean, I've got, some, PII, personal identifiable information, records to protect. In that regard, what are some important steps that SMB can take to protect themselves from a cyber attack, and what can they do to come into compliance with these insurance companies so that they can be assured that they will be getting the full value of a claim if they do get hit?
Well, I mean, there's really two things you have to look at. One is that the first one is that, if you are in any type of compliant industry or any type of regulated industry, you have to be compliant. You know, a lot of businesses, for instance, and everything else, they will go through and they'll I don't want to worry about some of the HIPAA stuff or the high tech side of it. Don't want to spend the money and everything else. But basically, you have to do it. There's no choice. You have to do those things. Now, the other aspect of what really solves, like protects a lot of things of small business, the basic things that you can do, it's really there's like four things. One is almost all the insurance companies now, any cyber policies, they all have some type of user training, and we provide it in all our security products. For security trainings, phishing emails, what to click on, what not to click on, and you have to go through those things. You got to do your due diligence. The second step is that if you're using any cloud service like Office 365, you want to get the right subscription that has the security software with it, but you want to deploy multi-factor authentication, period. The third thing that you do, you got to update your systems and you got to update your software. And the thing about, what's happened, I think when you brought your comment about the word using, the word and everything else, and someone wants to do like the volume license keys or get like a copy of words, they don't want all the updates. The problem is today you basically, subscriptions will give you the best chance of defense because they're constantly being updated against all attacks. I mean, if you look at like, Office 2010, for instance. Office 2010 was released in 2009, went into development in 2007. So when you start looking at software, that's 12 years old. So the concept, so that's the other thing. So you really look at those three things. It's like keep your systems updated. And then the fourth one is that if you have a set of, if you have hardware, you have devices and things that you can't get drivers for or firewalls or, a kind of a wireless access point that's no longer being offered, basically get rid of it and buy something that's basically current because you need to keep everything updated. So in a nutshell, it's really those four things you have to really do. You got to do user security training. And the user security trainings is, you're talking a couple bucks a month. And almost all cyber insurance policies will actually have, they'll give you those three things. Number two is you want to deploy multi-factor authentication on cloud services. If you do that, you will protect yourself 99% of the time. And the third thing is that you're going to have to keep your systems updated. And you're going to have to run the latest patches and everything else. And the fourth thing is that if you have hardware devices or other things that are no longer under warranty, but more really specific that you can't get any updates for the firmware or the drivers for them, basically go buy something new because those are going to be entry points into your environment. But if you take care of those four things and you manage it from that, and the cost is not that great to do that, you basically will take yourself from being that person that's going to get hit to that, to basically that, you know, that lighted house on the street with a with a protection one or an ATT security sign on it or an ADT, and when the bad actor comes, they'll see that lighted house and they'll go to the other one because they'll know that you, it's too much of a hassle to deal with you, and that's what you want to do.
Okay. No, in my go ahead.
No, I'm sorry.
Okay.
Go on.
In my opinion. Okay. Now, in my opinion, I get asked this question like, am I at risk or blah, blah, blah. But in my opinion, I think any organization is at risk for cyber attack. So that brings me up to two questions. Is there a particular industry or a market segment or even a particular business that's more prone to a cyber attack than another? And what does it mean? It's just a matter of when you'll be hit. Does it mean that you'll be hit tomorrow, 10 years from now, 5 years from now? Can you please elaborate on those two?
Yeah, I mean, this gets back when you have to think about it is that it's a business. You know, cyber attacks and everything else, it's a business. It generates billions upon billions of dollars a year in terms of the amount of money that you capture from people. So the question is that if you make the assumption that, and in fact, it's like, you know, the Department of Defense is rolling out the new specifications for DoD contractors and, you know, in terms of what they have to do and everything else. And they had this meeting, it's the best way to describe it. And they said, okay, they asked the question, is it, how many people have been breached? Stand up. And then they ask the question, says, how many people think they're going to be breached? And a lot of people don't. And he says, okay, and the person that gave the thing, the presentation basically says, now everybody stands up. And he says, now this is how you have to view it, because it's not if, it's when you're going to be breached. And what the federal government's doing in terms of the contractor space, they're putting the hooks in place so they get the notification and they can remediate the damage as soon as possible. And that's kind of the trend that's going on in the industry. So then you go back and look at how you handle it. When you do the certain things and certain tools, you're putting different security things in place. It goes back to my analogy of that house. Yeah, I mean, if you have a bunch of lighted house on the street with all the security sign, yeah, guess what? They'll pick one and they're going to go after one. But you want to make sure that you want to make it so that it's more expensive to go after you than anyone else. And that's the secret. And that's really what it is, because you keep in time of the industries they're going after. They're after to make money. And they're going after the organizations that they can be more effective in terms of how they can actually steal more assets and go. And the logical ones make sense. It's like, you know, the healthcare folks, they basically are really being targeted. You have MSPs, you know, like ourselves and others, we're being really targeted. The defense contractors, because basically they can go sell the secrets that they steal. You know, the financial in terms of the brokerage house or the small, you know, the small brokerage firms and everything else, or the wealth management firms are being targeted. But, you know, it's about money. And that's what you're going on. They're going after who they can make the most bang for the buck, because that's really what's driving it. It's money. And what we fail to realize at SMB, in my earlier discussion, you talk about the price of a landed customer, the price of information, all that has money. And that's what it's all about.
Wow.
And you think about it, it's about, you got organized crime into this now too. And you think about it is that you have the old days when you used to rob banks and break into buildings and everything else and go to jail or gunfights and all the other stuff. I mean, what other business can you rob people of billions of dollars and your risk of going to jail is so low that it's almost a game?
Well, yeah. Never thought of it that way before. Wow. Okay, now let's go to your company at Canon IT. Now, what kind of security plans do you offer? And I think you kind of mentioned that you have various different kinds of cybersecurity insurance policies. Should you go into all these different options that your clients or potential clients, prospects, what can they choose from?
Well, we really have three plans. We have three plans, environment, in terms of cyber, in terms of cybersecurity defense. We have a shield plan, which is our kind of our basic. It's good. It's our what we call the good plan. We have our armor, which is you a little bit step up, and that's really designed to partner with an IT organization that has an IT staff, and you have our fortress plan, our high end. So we have really shield, armor, and fortress. And the real difference is that, and the shield is more of like, it's really security on a budget and to realize what it is, where that will put some of the basic training, some of the things you need in place, but you as a business owner, you have to basically do all the security management. I mean, we'll set it up for you and everything else, but there really is, it's up to you to actually manage it. The popular plan that we actually have a lot of customers on, it's our armor plan. And what that is, that's more of an organization where we actually partner with the IT organization. So we work with them to figure out is that, okay, we'll remediate the breaches. We'll basically make sure we're aggressively attacking and defending the environment, and we're constantly changing these things. And what happens in this environment, we'll look at trends, and then we'll sit down and speak with the IT staff and say, okay, this is the type of things we're seeing. We would recommend to do this. We'll need your help as you're to go touch your clients, basically make sure these features are taken care of. We'll take care. It's more of a partnership arrangement. And the fortress plan is a little bit different. The fortress plan is the one where you do the hunters and we do the what-if analysis where we'll see a set of security breaches or attempted breaches coming through, and maybe it's a slow password attack that we'll see coming through, and we'll basically go through and run it against different scenarios and defense strategies against the previous data logs and look at what's happening and come up with a way to basically make sure that the organization is not going to have a data breach. And really when you look at different plans, it's one that's much more aggressive. We deal with issues. We're aggressively changing license mixes, changing configurations on the fly. That's what the Fortress plan does. And it's really designed to be that real-time manipulation of data to make sure the client's protected. And that's kind of the pieces and the stuff that we actually have. And that's really gives you, and it's all built on, the Microsoft security stack. And it's a layered solution.
Excellent. Now, once you create three different plans, are there sub-plans, in between these three main different plans? So what I'm trying to ask is, suppose if a client that their needs are so unique, none of these plans really work. Well, I mean, they will work, but they have something that's so unique and something so out of this world in terms of needs that simply using one service may not meet all their needs. You kind of have to take a mix of different things. Have you ever encountered that? And have you ever come up with a whole different plan for a customer with something that's so extraordinary that these three plans just can't meet those needs?
Well, the Fortress plan, what happens in those cases, and we do have one or two customers like that on our Fortress plan. In those cases, what happens is that we take the Fortress and we augment it. Like, for example, we have one client where we basically have a NIST 800-171 Rev2 in terms of compliancy, in terms of what they have on the cyber side, but also they need to do the business process side. So we have a model that basically on the Fortress plan that allows you to go do that because it really is the commitment and you have to actually do the necessary things. The other common one we've seen is that on our Fortress plan, we do kind of a very deep dive penetration testing. What's unique about the way we do it is that, you have the traditional thing you see in the ports and everything else. And you have honeypots and things like that on the inside the networks and try to figure out pieces. What we do in our penetration testing plans is it's a subscription service, but it's also structured so that we look at what the hardware types are and what the hardware environment you're deploying, and we actually take the penetration test and we tailor it to go after the security breaches or the software fixes and everything else that have not been deployed in that environment. So we actively, aggressively try to breach the hardware. And that's what's different in terms of, and that's usually, those are unique things that usually spin off in the fortress plans.
Okay. Now, in terms of your cybersecurity insurance, does a customer, can they buy that just as a standalone, or do they have to buy one of these services or get cybersecurity insurance? So, for example, suppose I go, hey, Matt, I don't really want any of your plans, but I'd like a cybersecurity insurance policy through you. Can you do that also for a small business?
No, I mean, we can't. We're not an insurance agent and broker, and every state's controlled and regulated. We will actually go and say in cases of, you know, we have an insurance broker that we actually use and that tailors for this environment. It's mostly like even when we actually go through and we'll recommend, hey, go contact them directly. Even when we recommend that someone's interested in the cyber option that we have in our Fortress plan, what happens is the arrangements directly between, and we don't get any kickbacks or anything like this. The arrangements basically between the end client and the insurance broker. It's mostly as a service because we're doing two things is that we deploy in terms of like the Fortress plans, the security standard that the insurance companies that our insurance brokers put in place. And that way they can basically, we feel more comfortable for our clients that if they work with them and there is a problem, that we'll not only stand behind it in our security plans, but our insurance broker will make up for any lost damages associated with it.
Okay, excellent. Now, Matt, as we come into 2020 here, it's kind of hard to believe where the time's gone. What are some of your top tips that you tell your clients or even a small business owner, or really, for that matter, just an average everyday individual, what can they do to protect themselves going into the new year from a cyber attack?
Well, it's really the four things that we talked about earlier. It's number one is that you have to deploy multi-factor authentication on your cloud services. That's really it in a nutshell. You want to be on a Office subscription. You want to make sure your updates are constantly updated. You want to go through some security training program to make sure you kind of recognize what you should and should not click on. And you want to, if the hardware products are out of date, no longer supported by the manufacturer, I mean, you can't get BIOS updates on your PCs, things like that, it's time to go get a new piece of hardware. Those are really the four pillars that you need. If you follow those, then basically you will basically reduce your risk of being attacked.
Okay. Now, here's, one of my top questions I ask everybody. What do you think the biggest cyber threat's going to be next year? As I blog, I come across all the news headlines that are saying, here's the top 20, here's the top 5, here's the top 8. I don't know. I think I'm most fearful of, phishing will always be there. I'm most fearful of an attack on critical infrastructure, like our gas supplies, oil supplies, water. In your opinion, as a cybersecurity professional with, the many years of experience that you have, what do you think the biggest threat's going to be next year in 2020?
Boy, that's really a good question. On looking at the crystal ball, if you look at if you look at what's going on this year, there's really two groups been targeted. You have tons of hospitals and everything being targeted, and which there's big bucks there, and basically going after the IT suppliers that are not basically don't have a good set of standard operating procedures in place. I think what's going to go happen, the targeting next year, it's going to be, my guess is you're going to see more of targeting for the basically the IT services suppliers, and specifically, and what's going to happen is you're going to look at people that don't have really good processes or are too big that they basically haven't pushed out a standard across the organization because it's too expensive. You're going to see very kind of targeted environments for that. And I think one of the things that is going to happen next year is we'll probably have the first inkling of the IT industry is going to become a regulated entity, is my guess.
Really?
Yeah, so okay, man, basically as an IT service provider, we're going to have to be compliant with like NIST 800-171 or, you know, whatever the new version of it is. That's pretty much going to happen.
Wow. Okay. Now, Matt, as we wrap up our show, how can potential, you know, our audience who's listening right now and people who download the show, how can they reach out to you for advice and to hopefully being procure services down the road here in 2020? Is there a URL that we can give to them, or is there what's the best way for them to get a hold of you?
Yeah, I mean, the best way is go to our website, to our contact page. And our website is www.kamind.com. That's camind.com. And go select the contact page and just go put a question in contact, and one of our associates will reach out to you. And our website has tons of information about cybersecurity and incident response, and we have blogs and, you know, white papers and everything else on there that kind of keep yourself out of trouble. It's a good resource place. But again, go to www.kamind.com. That's kamind.com.
Can people get a hold of you directly? Is there a direct way they can just come to you, or do you just prefer the website approach? Or
yeah, I mean, basically the website approach is really the best way, because that way I tend to track. And so email is not really the best way to get in touch with me. But if you get something through our website, through a contact, and just put a request to say, hey, I heard Matt on the blog radio and on the podcast, and I'm interested in more information. Yeah, just put my name in the contact, and we'll reach out to you and get something scheduled and see how we can help you.
Sounds like it, Matt. Matt, we thank you for your time. I think you shed a lot of light here, especially in two areas on what, you know, the Microsoft Cloud is, O365, and, you know, cybersecurity insurance policies. We'd love to have you come back on as a future podcast guest coming up here in Q1. So we wish you a very Merry Christmas and Happy New Year. Thanks for your time.
Well, yeah, thank you much, and wish you the best for happy holidays and good Christmas and all that good stuff, too. And I really appreciate it. This is a lot of fun to basically really let people know what you need to do. And I'm thank you very much for inviting me.
Well, I think this is one of the best podcasts I've had, man. It's been very informative. So thanks for your time. We'll reach out to you again in January. Take care.
Okay. Thanks again. Bye-bye.
Bye.